Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Hi, it's Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for listening to On Point. If you love this show, you may also love other great podcasts, shows, and journalism brought to you by NPR. When you support your local public radio station, it helps us keep our show going and helps NPR create new ones. The best way to keep On Point and NPR strong is to donate to your station. Visit donate.npr.org/onpoint to give. Then share why you did using the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. And thanks. From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A Pocahontas slur, retweets of racists' anti-Muslim videos, a revival of the birther conspiracy. That's all coming from the White House, from our president, just this week. Writer Adam Serwer argues in a big piece in The Atlantic that racism is at the heart of the Trump presidency, was at the heart of his campaign, and, he writes, was in the hearts of his voters, whether they say so or not. We'll hear him out, and we'll hear from conservative columnist Ross Douthat, who says, yes, but there's more to it. This hour on Point, race, racism, and the Trump presidency. You can join us on air or online. But this conversation is always on. How much weight do you give to racism in the election and presidency of Donald Trump? How much does it explain? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It has been quite a week, starting out with that comment the president made in the presence of Navajo code talkers, World War II heroes, really, in the White House in front of a portrait of Andrew Jackson, who signed the Indian Removal Act of 1830. The president, referring to indirectly Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren here, it was Pocahontas.
You're very, very special people. You were here long before any of us were here. Although we have a representative in Congress who they say was here a long time ago. They call her Pocahontas. But you know what? I like you because you are special.
Yeah, that got people's attention in a hurry, not least Senator Warren herself. Here she was.
It is deeply unfortunate that the President of the United States cannot even make it through a ceremony honoring these heroes without having to throw out a racial slur.
Media, well, hair on fire in the U.S. Here was Mika Brzezinski on MSNBC Morning Joe after all that talk.
That is unbelievable. This is our president, and that is the spokesperson for the president of the United States.
It is.
Sitting there defending his racism, his bigoted language, his stupidity. This is where we are.
And then it jumped the pond to the UK as the president retweeted anti-Muslim video from ultra-nationalists in the UK. Here's Member of Parliament Stephen Doty delivering an impassioned denunciation of President Trump's retweets. This was today on the floor of the House of Commons in the UK.
This is the President of the United States sharing with millions inflammatory and divisive content deliberately posted to sow hatred and division by, as the Home Secretary says, a convicted criminal who is facing further charges, who represents a vile fascist organization seeking to spread hatred and violence in person and online. By sharing it, he is either a racist, incompetent, or unthinking, or all three.
Wow. And that from the United Kingdom, the historically the closest ally in the world of the United States. Joining me now from Washington is Adam Serwer, senior editor at The Atlantic, covering politics. Everybody's been talking about his big essay on this big subject. This week it seems hyper-relevant. You can link to it at our website. The headline is The Nationalist's Delusion. It's at onpointradio.org. Adam Serwer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to look at what we've seen this week, but give us your big thesis first. The Nationalist's Delusion. You say not just in this presidency, but in the campaign, in the election of Donald Trump, in the votes and voters of Donald Trump, despite all the other explanations, you say racism.
Well, it's a little more complicated than
that.
What I'm saying is that the president ran on an agenda of using state violence against religious and ethnic minorities. And the way that his supporters rationalized supporting that is they told themselves that it wasn't actually racist for him to do that. And the president told himself it wasn't actually racist for him to do that. But part of the point is of the story is that, you know, decades ago the president, you know, was commenting on the race for David Duke, the race for Louisiana Senate in which David Duke participated.
Remind us, this was a former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
In 1990, David Duke, the former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, runs for Senate in Louisiana, and he completely sort of boxes out the Republican candidate. And he's running against, you know, the incumbent Democrat. And he does much better than is he's expected to. He gets about 43% of the vote. If it was just white voters, he got about 60% of the vote. He would have won in a landslide. And you know, Donald Trump.
This is a guy who used to show up at public events in a Nazi uniform.
Right. I mean, this is pretty much. It doesn't really get more blatantly, obviously racist than a man who was the leader of a racist organization that is, you know, modeled after the most deadly domestic terrorist group in American history. And, you know, Donald Trump, you know, he was on Larry King and he's discussing this and he's sort of perceiving the appeal of Duke and he's saying, you know, if this guy runs for president, he's going to get a lot of Republican votes. And then, you know, a few decades later, he's running for president and he's pretending he doesn't know who Duke is. But I think that's a key part of the story, which is it's not just that I'm saying this. It's that I think the president pretty clearly perceives that his racial appeals are important to his supporters, which is why he emphasizes them so greatly. It's why he gets in fights with black public figures, including you know, NFL players who are protesting racial inequality and policing. It's why he retweets videos from far-right fascist groups in Britain attacking Muslims. He perceives his appeal to his supporters as being rooted in his disapproval of these religious and ethnic minorities, and he acts accordingly.
Let's back it up for a minute here. To the campaign and the explanations for the victory, and you say an awful lot of analysts just got it wrong. They were in denial or refused to or didn't want to see the sort of racial explanation that you say is right at the heart of it. People said, well, this is about white economic disenfranchisement, white disillusion. This is about the white working class in despair looking for a hero. You're saying no, or that's not enough.
Right. So, you know, I think, you know, the point of the piece is not that this group of people isn't suffering, but that their suffering was mediated through an ideological lens that made it possible for Donald Trump to appeal to them in these terms. And I think it's really important to remember that, you know, despite all the emphasis on the white working class, Hillary Clinton actually won voters making less than $50,000 a year. She won them by a lot. And what Trump did was he won white voters of all income levels. And similarly, the press and a lot of commentators in the Duke case in Louisiana, they emphasized the Duke's appeal to the white working class. But Duke also, you know, beat the Democrat in the, you know, wealthy white suburbs. And I make this argument to say that, you know, there's a way in which making it about the white working class and economic suffering is sort of an attempt at absolution. It says, you know, these people had no choice. Like they weren't, you know, no one else was speaking to them. But he wasn't just speaking to them. He was speaking to people, white people of all income classes. And, you know, when you look at the people who were tremendously affected by the last recession, you know, a lot of them are people of color. I mean, you look at the Fed study, people of color's wealth was absolutely wiped out by the housing crisis, in part because of predatory financial practices that led to that crisis. But there's no sort of nationalist, you know, ethnocentric reaction. Or there's no radicalization that occurred in those communities. And that's because ideologically, those communities are not mediating their suffering in the same way that the communities that Donald Trump was appealing to are.
Adam, you remind us that if you ask Americans, they will tell you straight up they're opposed to racism overwhelmingly. You posed the question in your big piece. You say, how could Americans, the vast majority of whom say they oppose racism, back a racist candidate? What's your answer?
Well, my answer is that Americans have a long history of denying that they're racist. And this and as a way of giving a couple of examples, I point out that some of the most famous bigots in our history have said that they weren't racist. There was, Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy, who gave the famous Cornerstone speech saying that the cornerstone of Confederate society was that the black man was not equal to the white man. And then, a few years later, the war is over, he's in prison, and he's writing about it, and he's like, oh, that speech, that was not true. The reporter got it wrong. I tried to correct him, but he didn't listen to me. I actually have no problem with black people. I wasn't really that into slavery. This is the vice president of the Confederacy. And George Wallace, Alabama Governor George Wallace, who was sort of a symbol of segregation for standing in the schoolhouse door, he said something similar, towards the end of his life. He's like, white people in the South aren't racist. They love black people. They just felt that this Jim Crow arrangement was best for everyone involved. So where I locate that is like, America is a society that's, based on the idea that everyone's created equal. But in fact, it was a society that created on that principle that in which people were allowed to own black people as property. So the contradiction is just sort of baked into our national identity. And what I think it does is that it leads people to deny that they're being racist, no matter how racist they're actually being. And that includes people like the vice president of the Confederacy.
Though the denial is not necessarily required anymore, you say. You write, these supporters will not change their minds because this is what they always wanted. A president who embodies the rage they feel toward those they hate and fear while reassuring them that that rage is nothing to be ashamed of, that's not denial. That's kind of sanctioning.
Well, it's denial in that they wouldn't put it that way. But it's, my part of what I'm trying to do in this essay is to show that they're rationalizing. They're not admitting to themselves what they're doing. But they're still behaving as though that's what they wanted all along, and I think that's what's really important.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about racism in the presidency and the campaign of Donald Trump in the wake this week of Pocahontas, anti-Muslim tweets, the revival of the birther myth, with a writer who says race and white racism are central to this presidency. Adam Serwer has written a big essay in The Atlantic. You can link to it at our website, and he's with us today from Washington. You can join us as well. Are a whole lot of Americans, President Trump's winning majority, racist and just won't or can't admit it? Trump voters, what do you say? Was it too easy or wrong to say this was about economic distress? Was that ignoring or denying racism? Whites nervous that their privileged position was eroding, looking for that kind of champion. Ross Douthat, conservative columnist for the New York Times, joins us in a moment. He says Adam's onto something, but it was not that simple, says Douthat. Trump was asked a couple of years ago by CNN's Don Lemon if he was a racist. Here was that exchange.
Are you racist?
I am the least racist person that you have ever met. I am the least racist person.
Are you bigoted in any way?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
No, he doesn't think so. And after the retweets of the white nationalist, the British nationalist that has Theresa May's government up in arms and certainly parliamentarians in the UK up in arms, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House spokesperson, asked about all that. If these videos weren't verified, if they were misrepresented, if they were untruthful, here was her response.
I'm not talking about the nature of the video. I think you're focusing on the wrong thing. The threat is real. And that's what the president is talking about, is the need for national security, the need for military spending. And those are very real things. There's nothing fake about that.
Nothing fake about that. Never mind if the videos are in all kinds of question or and it's true, as we heard the parliamentarian say earlier, that the woman who first retweeted them has been convicted and facing new charges in the UK around hate and incitement of hate. Adam Serwer, what's the evidence in the first year of the president's nearly now time in office that might support or contradict your thesis here?
Well, I think the strongest support for the thesis is the president's actions himself. I mean, he's reneged on most of the promises that were economically related. He's in the midst of pushing for an extremely regressive tax cut that raises taxes on much of his base and cuts services for much of his base while lowering taxes on rich people. But he is, you know, his Justice Department has pulled back on making sure that police are held accountable for abusing their powers. It's pulled back on protecting voting rights. It's stepped up immigration enforcement despite claiming that, you know, he's going after criminals. He's, you know, rescinded the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which affects hundreds of thousands of people who were brought here as children who are not criminals, who are, you know, vetted by the government. We're hearing stories about, you know, people with American children being accosted by government agents at churches, at schools. And he attempted to implement a ban on from, you know, several mostly Muslim countries from coming to the United States. I mean, I think it's been very clear that the sort of ethno-nationalist component of the president's platform is the one that he sincerely believes in and has pursued, whereas all the stuff about not cutting Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid was entirely insincere. And yet what you see is that his core supporters, his most ardent ones – I'm not talking about the marginal Trump voter, but his core supporters, you know, are quite happy with what he's doing. And I think that explains a lot both about his expectations of his base and his base's expectations of him.
And your explanation for that satisfaction, despite what you see as him having let those core supporters down in many material ways, is what?
I think it's that they wanted a president who is going to place the social and political hegemony of white Christians at the core of the administration. I think that over the Obama years, and particularly the election of Barack Obama, caused a sort of was a profoundly radicalizing force for a lot of white Americans. They experienced it as a kind of psychological wound that, you know, Trump was able to exploit by denying that the president was even American in the first place, which was, you know, not coincidentally the way that he first rose to political prominence in the Republican Party. You know, in that sort of definition of American, which says that, you know, white Christians are the real Americans and the rest of us are sort of guests, is visible not only in the president's rhetoric but in the way that he approaches policy. And I think it's understandable that people who, you know, wouldn't want to admit that publicly or wouldn't want to admit it frankly, but I think it's pretty clear based on people's actions, you know, that that's what really matters both to the president himself and to his most ardent supporters.
Adam Serwer writes, Americans act with the understanding that Trump's nationalism promises to restore traditional boundaries of race, gender, and sexuality. The nature of that same nationalism is to deny its essence, he writes, the better to solve the conscience and spare the soul. It is a very tough piece. I mean, it's tough overall on this country, and it's manifest history. Lee in Charleston, South Carolina. Lee, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I live in a pretty high-level socioeconomic group. I'm not a Trump supporter, but many, many, many of my friends are. The argument that I hear put forward to me is that we are not racist and we do want to enable and support others. However, they are more concerned about protecting what is, quote-unquote, theirs. And its idea, the idea is or my family pulled itself up by its bootstraps. These other people need to do that, and it's not my job to do that. And I need to protect, quote unquote, my own.
Does that sound racist to you, or just practical to you? How do you hear it in Charleston, Lee?
I think they hear it as practical. I hear it as small r racist. I hear it as, wow, what you may not understand that this becomes of you including your own becomes excluding others, which is a form of racism indeed.
Adam, what do you say to Lee's observation there in South Carolina?
Well, I think, you know, I think she's making a good point. And part of what I try to get at in my piece is that, you know, we're not talking about – these people aren't Klan members. They're not extremists. You know, but we forget that racism as official policy in the United States had great popular support and existed as law until the 1960s. Even, you know, in public opinion, a majority of Americans didn't approve of interracial marriage until the 90s. And, you know, these people are a lot of these people are still alive. They're still with us. I think part of the problem and part of the reason that the piece is titled The Nationalist Delusion, it doesn't simply apply to Trump supporters. It really applies to everybody. It applies to the myths that America tells about itself, not just in terms of, you know, Trump voters voting for Trump and why they did it, but also in terms of the progress we've supposedly made as a country on this issue of racial discrimination. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, racism as policy had great popular support until a few generations ago, and those people simply didn't disappear. Despite, you know, the comforting tales we tell ourselves about having overcome.
You put a pretty sharp point on that. You talk about the president's what you call his commitment to endorsing state violence to remake the country into something resembling an idealized past that has not wavered. The president has not wavered. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on. Thanks, Steve. You're on.
Tom, I think the problem with your guest's hypothesis is that the term racism is so broad and used so much now that really it's often used simply to smear people and to silence any opposition to any kind of political or public policy that you are in favor of.
I mean, Steve, I get what you're saying, but when the president's saying Pocahontas, in front of Native American heroes, when he's retweeting British ultra-nationalist white supremacists, when he's still pumping the birther conspiracy, does it seem so broad or does it seem kind of pointed?
I think, again, this is used by Trump opponents and people who really have a very, very dim view of most Americans who are not in elites. And yes, he uses very careless language, but I think it's put too much into it. And my last point, Tom, is that, you know, the people who use this term racist to describe so many of us Americans, are often people who live in very affluent, liberal enclaves. So, it really is, I think, very ironic that they would use this term so much.
Steve, we got it. Adam, are you a highfalutin elitist just tossing it around carelessly?
Well, I am a highfalutin elitist, but I'm also a black man who went to public school in Washington, D.C. And so this idea that racism is just a concern of elitists. There's, the most vulnerable people in this country are people of color, financially. Most people who voted in the last election, who were making less than $50,000 a year, voted for the other person, and people of color voted for the other person overwhelmingly. So I think this idea that racism is just a concern of white elites and cloistered environments is, I think it's not borne out either by the data or by the political behavior of the people who are being now affected by Trump policies and who warn that they would be affected by these policies.
Steve, check out the piece. I mean, you may not agree with it, but it is long and it is a well-constructed piece of work. Adam Serwer has written it up for The Atlantic. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. He's with us in Washington. I want to go to New Haven, Connecticut right now, and Ross Douthat. He's opinion columnist, conservative for The New York Times, writes about politics and religion and moral values and higher education, lots. Very thoughtful man in his own right. Ross Douthat, really appreciate you being with us. Welcome back to On Point.
Sure. It's great to be back. And hey, Adam.
Hey, Ross. How's it going?
All right. How are you?
Ross, we've invited you because you've got one of the more pointed and thoughtful responses, in part response, to what Adam's written here. I mean, you tip your hat to him. You say he's got some things quite right or well put, but it's kind of a yes, but that response as I read you. Ross, what's your reaction?
I mean, I thought Adam's piece was powerful and interesting and made lots of good points. I wrote in opposition in part because I thought it was reductionist. I thought that, that the reality of the president's forays into race baiting can become something that obscures the complexity of the Trump phenomenon and everything it represents. And so I think the arguments that Adam makes are incredibly important for conservatives, especially to listen to. I think that the reality of the Trump era should reveal to a lot of people on the right that a kind of white identity politics and racial resentment has been and remains more important to the conservative coalition than a lot of conservative intellectuals, I think, probably myself included at times, have wanted to admit. But at the same time, I think that, this is a country of 315 million people with a lot of very complicated and tangled motivations going on. And the Trump campaign was pitched in a lot of different directions. The arguments Trump made were pitched at times to racial resentment. At times, they were pitched to economic anxiety. At times, they were pitched strongly to a general and, I think, entirely reasonable dissatisfaction with the Republican Party first as an institution and then in the general election to the sort of broad governing elite of our country. And I think that for liberals to sort of fall back on the sort of it's just racism, it's primarily racism, it's essentially white nationalism obscures, both, I think, the reasonable reasons that people were drawn to what Trump was saying and the arguments that he made.
Ross, forays into race baiting is how you describe the president's behavior. But, of course, as you've read from Adam, Adam sees it as more or less the offering of a full agenda of trying to the Make America Great Again thing. He interprets as taking the country back to what he calls an idealized past that, has not wavered, and what he would see as a white supremacist past. What about that interpretation, Ross?
I mean, I don't think Trump has a, sweeping coherent agenda to take America back to a white supremacist past. I think he has a semi-coherent agenda to make life more uncomfortable for illegal immigrants and to make life a little more comfortable for, bad or racist police departments in some parts of the country. And the latter is certainly a bad thing. The former, I'm a skeptic of high immigration rates, so I have sort of more mixed feelings about Trump's policies there. But either way, I think you should be able to critique those policies without describing them as a return to the status quo ante of, the Jim Crow South in 1955. And I think if Trump were running on a more sweeping and sort of overtly white supremacist platform, he would have received less support than he did. And I think that, again, that, if you watch Trump during the campaign, and for my sins, I watched every single Republican primary debate. I watched the convention. I watched his debate performance and so on. The race-based and white identitarian arguments were one thread woven into a much larger narrative that did. I mean, I think this is one of the points of disagreement I have with Adam. He sort of talks dismissively about the idea that Trump and Bernie Sanders, for instance, had something in common in their arguments. I think Trump and Sanders had a lot in common in their populist critiques of Washington corruption, in the specific policy positions which Trump has now walked away from as president, but which were, again, crucial to the public arguments that he made over and over again. And we can get into, what the public's reaction to his actual governing says about the nature of his support. But at least if you look at the sweep of his campaign and the nature of his campaign rhetoric, it was the Iraq War. It was Libya. When he was attacking Hillary Clinton, he was attacking her for her connections to Wall Street and Goldman Sachs. He was attacking her for her connections to failed foreign policy. He was moving the Republican Party really to the center on a lot of different economic issues, sort of running against the kind of Paul Ryan style government cutting and so on. And all of those were also important to his progress to the presidency. And again, I think that Adam works too hard to try and write them out of the story in order to focus on a very real and important part of Trump's success.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about racism in the presidency and campaign of Donald Trump. That's the charge. In the wake this week of Pocahontas, anti-Muslim tweets, the revival of the birther myth, with a writer who says race and white racism are central to this presidency, Adam Serwer, senior editor at The Atlantic. You can link to that piece at our website, onpointradio.org. And was with Ross Douthat of The New York Times, who's saying, well, yes, we have some of this going on here, but let's look at more than that. It has been quite a week with Pocahontas and all the rest. People up in arms in the U.K. About the president of the United States retweeting white nationalists there. On Monday, after playing a series of clips showing President Trump insulting various ethnic and racial groups, CNN's Don Lemon challenged the president's assertion that he is not a racist.
Here's what everyone should know. Just because you say you're not racist doesn't make it so. Especially if you say, do, and defend racist behavior over and over and over again. Especially if you have lost your credibility by telling countless lies, big and small.
Okay, there's a pretty sweeping condemnation from Don Lemon, but there are ramifications here. Whether or not you put it completely in that box, yesterday you had the former director of national intelligence, James Clapper, criticizing the president for retweeting those inflammatory, unverified videos from a far-right British account filled with anti-Muslim content. Here was Clapper.
So it has all kinds of ripple effects, both in terms of perhaps inciting or encouraging anti-Muslim violence, and as well causes, I think, our friends and allies around the world to wonder about the judgment of the President of the United States.
Words matter, actions matter, retweets, it turns out, matter. Adam, I want to come to you on Ross's sort of counter-critique here, but a couple of calls first, if I may. Charity in Austin, Texas. Charity, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you think, Charity?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling here today because as a Black American, I agree with both of your panelists. I agree that Donald Trump does provide a pathway on the race issue for racist and nationalist people, and white nationalists. Now, I also believe that it's a matter of tact on the other side. I mean, you know, obviously, in any position, you are held to standards, and his standard as the president of the United States is to represent all of us. And I think that Trump supporters came in. I don't think that they're all racist. I think that some of them were responding to, you know, policy and things like that. But I personally don't agree with his national agenda. I just also don't agree with his tact. It's just not representative of the large amount of people that we have here in the U.S. and as you're seeing kind of like in the world with the U.K. being upset over his, you know, anti-Muslim post.
But Charity, may I ask you, I get it, and you're very sort of even-handed here, but as an African-American, does this president and his election give you confidence and hope that you will be treated as a full equal in this society, in his presidency, and down the road?
Honestly, it's more as a poor person, if you will, like as a person that owns student loans and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't feel as safe on the streets because Donald Trump is, like I said, providing a pathway for these people who are saying all these. I feel like I'm going out to battle every day, but I'm really worried about his financial, the tax cuts as well, and the health plans as well.
Got it. Charity, I appreciate your call. Adam Serwer, Charity in Austin, Texas, sees a president creating a pathway for racists. Ross Douthat sort of buys that in some significant part, but says if it's reductionist to look at just that, there's more going on here. Your piece spends a lot of time saying don't be misled by the other things going on. This is the heart of it. So how do you respond, Adam?
My disagreement with Ross may actually be smaller than it seems. I'm clear in the story. You know, it's pretty early on in the story. I mentioned that other factors also led to Trump's victory. But the argument is that had racism been toxic to the American electorate, Trump just, you know, he never would have exited the Republican primary. His candidacy would have died there. And I think, you know, while there are other factors involved in his election, this is I would say it's not the only factor, but it is an indispensable factor in understanding what happened.
I mean, pretty key. You write, a majority of white voters backed a candidate who assured them that they will never have to share this country with people of color as equals. That is the reality. You write that all Americans will have to deal with, and one that most of the country has yet to confront. That's pretty strong, Adam.
Yeah, but I think that's reflected in both the president's platform and his governing.
I mean, Ross, do Republicans have to grapple with this? You know, you can sit here and say, I mean, Adam's written a whole big piece reminding us of our history, saying racism has been central in that history, and we got a president trying to turn us back to it. So what's the right response in that case, Ross, to say, well, yes, but it's more complicated, or to say we have to deal with this head on?
I mean, I think it's both. I think for people who are Republicans and conservatives who want to believe in a conservatism that has left or partially left America's white supremacist past behind, a lot of elements of the president's methods and a lot of elements within his support should be wake up calls. And I think they, you know, at the elite level, to some extent, they have been, that, you know, there is a sort of contingent within what used to be conservative media, what we used to think of as the conservative media firmament, who are trying to grapple with some of this stuff. But yeah, I think, and this is the point, you know, the point where I agree with Adam is that it's true that there is what this election revealed was, even among Trump voters who weren't, you know, interested in the birther conspiracies and, you know, the playing footsie on Twitter with white supremacists and so on, there was ultimately a tolerance for this stuff. There was a decision that, you know, whatever the dangers of racism are, the dangers of Hillary Clinton in the White House were worse. And that's the reality. At the same time, I think the idea that most Republicans thought of themselves, even at a subconscious level, I know there's a conscious and subconscious element here, and the piece is all about this sort of delusion of the lies people tell themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that it's, you know, that it's sort of it's seen as a defense or understood at some level as a defense of, you know, the idea that you don't have to share the country with minorities and so on. I think that that's an overgeneralization of, again, you know, there were a lot of people who voted for Trump because they felt like they'd gotten screwed over by economic policies, trade policies, and everything, for legitimate reasons over the last 15 or 20 years. There were a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump because they felt, again, I think reasonably, that political liberalism had developed a sustained hostility to the religious liberty of their churches and schools and institutions. And, you know, and you can go down the list. And again, in each of those cases, the people voting that way were prioritizing that issue over the fact that Trump or his associates were playing footsie with white supremacists and that Trump indulges in racist forays and all of that. And that's, you know, that's reality. That's the truth. They were privileging and prioritizing things that way.
With our history, is that okay, Ross? I mean, with the history of this country, is it all right to put other things above that if you've got a president who, Adam says, is...
Well, I was against Trump. Yeah. So I suppose my answer in part is no, although I think that there were other... You know, I had other reasons for being against Trump, too. It was a multi-variable process.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, you know, I mean, look, I'm pro-life. I think abortion is killing and should be against the law in a civilized society. I think that that's a very, very important issue. And I wrestled a lot with the idea of sort of saying, well, what is more important, that sort of that particular moral absolute, in this case, the fact that Trump will appoint justices who will make it easier to make abortion illegal and so on. And I knew, you know, I knew a lot of people who share my views who wrestled with it and ended up voting for Trump. And I think it's a mistake. I just think it's a mistake to see a vote cast with that, you know, that weighing of issues in mind as a vote for a kind of racist hegemony. It may be a mistake. It may be a miscalculation. And since I didn't support Trump, obviously I thought it was. But it's important for liberals to understand the mental calculus in which this vote was made for a lot of different reasons by a lot of different Americans.
Yeah.
And the way Trump campaign played to different things. I mean, we've lived through a period over the last 15 years of sequential elite failure, much of it from the Republican Party, but at a bipartisan level. And the Democratic Party nominated a candidate, maybe the only candidate they could have nominated, who was connected to all of these failures, who had voted for the Iraq War, who had been the candidate, you know, who had supported Wall Street proposals and so on. And that reality also has to be part of the reckoning with what happened in 2016.
Adam, do you hear all of that as explanation or obfuscation? I mean, do we end up normalizing racism here, normalizing it?
I think Ross is making a very good argument both about Hillary Clinton's flaws as a candidate and about the sort of moral calculus that some people who may have voted despite for Trump despite his views. But I think ultimately, particularly with the issue of the reasons people voted. I mean, I phrased that specific sentence in a particular way. To put the emphasis on what Trump was going to do, not on what the voters themselves, may have been thinking when they cast a ballot.
But what
and
is
the reason is that the reason is that, you know, ultimately, if you cast a ballot for Trump, whether it was because you wanted tax cuts or you wanted to deport 11 million undocumented immigrants, the impact is the same. I mean, ultimately, your intentions sort of don't really matter. I mean, the fact it doesn't make a difference, you know, for someone who is, you know, for a kid who's getting walked to school and watching their dad get taken away by ICE. Like the moral distinction does not exist for that person. And I think, you know, when weighing the consequences of this presidency, you ultimately have to really look at the actual consequences and not sort of just be satisfied with saying, well, some people may not have meant it that way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I have to ask you, Adam, I mean, you write that this president continues to pursue a program that places the social and political hegemony of white Christians at its core. How do we deal with that, given the diversity of this country? If you're right, I just don't see a way to take that in any way casually. We have so many people in this country who are not white. They're not necessarily Christian. We have a constitution that is supposed to be open to all. If that's the program, how do we deal with that?
Well, look, I don't actually know what the answer is to that question. I mean, I think that's something that the country is going to have to figure out. I do say that I don't think that this kind of politics is invincible. It's been defeated before. There have been many, you know, throughout American history, there have been many instances of sort of this kind of ethno-nationalist politics coming to the fore and creating policy and causing real damage to the fabric of the country. But, you know, there are coalitions that come together that, rise and that defeat it. And, you know, maybe that'll happen this time. I don't know what the most effective way of doing that is. I'm not a political consultant. But I do think that it's something that we sort of have to recognize that regardless of the reasons that people voted for Trump, they voted for someone who, you know, placed this agenda at the core of his administration and his campaign.
One more call here. Bill in Austin, Texas. Bill, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hey, here's my question. Where is the Republican leadership in all this? And specifically, the Muslim retweets, to me, is just out of bounds. And I expected some of the Republican leaders to say something. And this silence really, really disturbs me at a fundamental level.
Ross?
I mean, this sort of gets to this sort of who's to blame question. But I think, broadly speaking, I blame a certain subset of Republican leaders for some of this as much or more than I blame actual Republican voters. I think in general, from early on in the Trump campaign, there was first this sense among Republican leaders that he couldn't possibly win. So there wasn't a need to sort of draw a quarantine around the noxious elements of Trumpism because he wouldn't win.
But a certain subset, Ross, forgive me, but our time is short, but a certain subset, I mean, where I think
well, I just mean that there are actual, you know, lots of Republican, you know, former presidents, United States senators refused to vote for Trump and have condemned him and so on. There is a section of the Republican leadership that has taken the kind of stance that the caller wants to see, but it doesn't extend to
pretty quiet
people at the heart of power, the Mitch McConnells and Paul Ryans and others.
Those who are the leaders right now.
Trump did have much less support from elite Republicans than any presidential nominee in my lifetime. when you know he was unendorsed by former Republican president. It's not the case that there was no institutional Republican.
Yeah, but now,
people like Jeff Flake have given speeches on the Senate floor attacking him. I mean, this stuff exists. The problem is that the Republicans who are in the position to do something about it have preferred, for the sake of party unity and their political agenda and so on, to sort of say sorrowful things about it, but ultimately go along with it. I mean, the bottom line is on the race stuff, the retweets, and everything else, you know, Republicans in Washington know that Donald Trump is unfit for office. And to them, sort of figuring out what to do about that is too hard. And so they want to act as if everything will go back to normal and hope that eventually it will. That's sort of the bottom line, and that's been the way it's been since he won the nomination.
Adam, what's your fear if Republican leadership, which has all three branches of government, go along with it?
Well, look, I think it's pretty obvious why they're going along with it. They're tolerating Donald Trump's behavior because they want to give tax cuts to the wealthiest people in American society, and we're seeing that play out in Congress right now, and I don't think they have any other big priorities.
Wow. These are large terms. Yes, complications, but what a frame to be looking at our country through in 2017, and here we are listening to what we hear and listening for what we don't. I'm very grateful to the two of you for being with us this hour with all of your thoughts. Adam Serwer, who wrote all this up for The Atlantic, big piece there. Adam, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Ross Douthat with his thoughtful reply. Ross, thank you for your time today and insights.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thanks as always for joining us today. You can continue this conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website or wherever you get podcasts. Go to onpointradio.org or wherever you pull them down. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.